The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
That is very good.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cricket Podcast with me, Jack Hope, and Ross Legg. How are you doing, Ross?
Marvellous, thank you, mate. How are you?
Yeah, you know, not too bad. Had my work Christmas party this afternoon. A little bit earlier on in the day, we spoke with Jared Kimber. It's been all go on my front.
What did you do for your work party? Did you do like an online cocktail class? Or what's the thing?
No, we had like online drink whichever beverage you want. So I had a glass of Pinotage. Then alongside that, we played Pictionary and did a quiz. So you know, probably better in many ways than physical, real Christmas parties. And then in some other ways, not better.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real lack of consequence, and I quite like that as a thing in Christmas parties.
Anyway, this week on the Cricket Podcast, we're mainly talking with Jared Kimber. As I said, me and Max spoke with Jared for about an hour earlier on today. It was a great chat. We covered everything. I mean, it was a really eclectic conversation with topics ranging from Basil de Oliveira and his experience coming out of South African cricket and the issues with race that the game still has to some extent. And then sort of extending on to Jared's time as a general manager in the CPL. It was a really entertaining chat, so that will be the second half, and by half I mean most of the show. But before we get into that, we do have a little bit of cricket news for us to get through. New Zealand have been in action against West Indies. We'll be touching on that. India v Australia. That test series is about to kick off. And Mushfiqur Rahim tried to punch one of his teammates on the pitch. So we'll be sharing our thoughts on how good the punch was, I think. Ross, we're going to pretty much dive straight into that. But before we do, what do our listeners need to know?
They need to know where to follow us, and it's at The Cricket Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on all the podcast platforms that you use, and subscribe on iTunes if you would like to.
That's sage advice. Where would you like to start, Ross? We've got New Zealand, we've got India, we actually had some England squad news as well.
Well, I'm going to start with where's Rohit?
Where's Rohit? Let's go. Where is Rohit then?
Yeah, so where's Rohit Sharma currently? So obviously he's on his way. He's on his way to Australia. He's been in quarantine. He's seen his dad. He's lost a bit of weight. He's rebuilt his hamstring. Rohit is on a plane currently as we speak on his way to Australia.
That's good to hear. So the four test series between India and Australia, that kicks off from the 17th, if they haven't changed the date since Max told us that last week. When does that mean Rohit Sharma will be in play, and what does that mean for India's team in the tests before the Sharmanator turns up?
So he'll be back for the third and fourth test matches, apparently. He's going to definitely be a little bit rusty. There's obviously no pre-games or anything like that, but maybe his class will outdo any kind of pre-match kind of preparation. For India, that means that there's a bit of trouble at the top. Just like there seems to be, or there has been for England, there has been for Australia with injuries, etc. We'll come on to a bit. But for India, it means that there's going to be a bit of a reshuffle. So they've got Agarwal, who sits at the top, and Prithvi Shaw, who had a torrid IPL, like an absolutely torrid time opening up for the Delhi Capitals in the IPL, is in contention. However, KL Rahul, who's in a rich vein of form of stat padding, and Shubman Gill, who is actually Gavaskar's pick. And I think if you're Gavaskar, and I think India, I'm not too sure Gavaskar's picks throughout the years, but we've talked about Gavaskar before, haven't we, of his kind of batting for days on end. And he quite likes the look of Gill. So who are we to disagree?
Okay, that's good. From the Australian point of view, you mentioned there were some injuries. Who is out for them?
So Pukowski took a blow to the head. I think he's 10th career concussion, which makes him sound like a boxer, and he's definitely out. David Warner is unfortunately out as well. I think that's a moustache related incident. And then where you've got Joe Burns, who's hit 62 runs in 9 first class games recently, so he's not in the best of form. Which kind of leaves them with an option, really. They've kind of got Matthew Wade, who could potentially come in.
As an opener, are you saying here?
As an opener, at the moment. So, yeah, the old makeshift small man syndrome has obviously replaced Warner, Matthew Wade.
And are Renshaw and Bancroft not in contention for some reason?
It's Marcus Harris at the top.
Okay, I guess the other two are not in the bubble or something like that, so they... Australia having to press Matthew Wade into a position that he probably wouldn't be ideally cut out for, you wouldn't think.
Yeah, well, they say he's got all the credentials for a good test opener. And I'm not entirely sure I agree with that. But that's the kind of thing that they're saying.
So. What credentials does Matt Wade have
So there was a quote from Langer saying he's got an aggressive style that could complement what we like to do as Australian openers, and he's got good foot movement. So,
all right. Look, we aren't picking him, and Australia are. So we'll see who's right.
We also have to remember that Matthew Wade is a better cricketer than both of us. So who are we to judge him? that's what we need to really figure out.
Anyone else out for Australia? So it sounds like all of their openers.
So Steve Smith had a back spasm today, if we're talking about that. So he is now a risk for the game, but I can imagine they'll lube him up and throw him out into the ring, and I'm sure he'll be fine. But then the prodigy and the next Ricky Ponting, as he's been dubbed, Cameron Green, has been he's set to feature if he passes the concussion tests.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like both teams have had some trouble there. Ross... Last week we did make some predictions on air. I think you said India might win the series. Was it 2-1? Are you going to stick with that, bearing in mind the injuries?
Well, Kohli's not there, is he? So that's a huge loss for India. Like, absolutely huge loss. It is only their second game under lights, so the daylight test match at Adelaide. So that's going to be interesting, where they played Bangladesh before and quickly got rid of those. I think one of the interesting things here is about who they picked to wicket keep and the it's between Saha, who are we a fan of Ruman Saha? We did once compare him to Louis Saha, so maybe not. and then Rishabh Pant, who we are a fan of. I think India are going to shoot themselves in the foot and pick Saha over Pant. I would be picking Pant if I was them.
I can't really... Everyone says Pant is the next big thing, but I, for whatever reason, have just never seen it. Until I see it, I refuse to believe that he is. So,
he hit 100 in one of the warm-up games. So we'll see if they decide to not pick him off.
I didn't see it. So how do I know it even happened?
Very, very true.
If Rishabh Pant scores a century and I don't see that he scored the century, did he score the century?
Great question. And they've obviously got a good bowling lineup. I think they're going to go with Yadav to support Shami and Bumrah. Jadeja's racing to be fit as well, but Ashwin's not a bad replacement if they decide to play him. So, it's going to be interesting. So I think I'm going to stick with my prediction that India are going to overturn the Aussies purely on the base that I want them to.
I think I said 3-0 Australia. It sounds like Australia have probably got the worst of the injury luck, although their bowling contingent is still... relatively or completely unharmed. I'm going to stick with 3-0 Australia. Where would you like to go next?
The BBL. And I just want to say that I have zero interest in the Big Bash League.
Okay. Is that all you want to say? Where would you like to go next?
I was just going to put it out to you around the IPL is really, really interesting because of the way in which it works. The fact that the BBL has none of the key Australian players in because they're all playing test cricket just means there's a real lack of interest from me. Is that the same for you?
I think the problem for me is time zones. So one, I agree the quality is worse. But two, the games, like, they're just not on at a great time for people in the UK. I don't want to wake up at 5 in the morning or earlier to watch a not particularly high quality T20 match featuring players I've mainly never heard of. And two, even if I did want to do that, they kind of bleed into the working day. So you can't, you wouldn't be able to watch the conclusion. I've sort of followed a little bit. I've seen the conclusion of a couple of games that have been close. One of the nice things about it is you can sort of choose to tune in for the last 20 minutes if it does look like it's going to go close. I saw Daniel Sams score 65 off 25 balls. That was quite good. But it's, I mean, I think the Big Bash is probably the model for what they want with the 100 in that it's very easy to consume. It's not particularly complex, or it wasn't until they added all the crazy rules. And it's not... I don't think it has pretensions, really, to be the next IPL. It's very much just... It's served up as fun. And I can see why people like it in that context. But for the reasons I said, I'm not waking up to watch it.
Yeah, well, as a T20 cricket purist, I'm sick and tired of it, that's what I am. but Peter Siddle, he took a fifer. He's evergreen. But he's, I think he's inspired himself by having a slim, shady haircut.
I did see the haircut.
He's bleached blonde his hair to look, I don't know, like a curly-haired Ellen DeGeneres. I'm not sure it's a good look for him.
I would agree. I mean, like, discussing haircuts on a podcast never really goes over that well. Not a visual medium. But if you want to Google it or look it up on Twitter, it's worth probably the 10 seconds of your time for the laugh that you'll get at the end of it. BBL done. We've got two more topics on docket, or maybe three. Where would we like to go next? We've got England. Well, we've got Mushfiqur Rahim.
We'll finish on England. So what's happening in New Zealand versus West Indies, Jack?
Well, we can finish this off quite quickly, or we can do this bit quite quickly. New Zealand absolutely tonked the West Indies again. They won by an innings. This time, the West Indies managed to make it okay for the first session or two of the match. They hadn't lost the game by lunch or something ridiculous. However, after that, it was largely downhill. I mean, they improved. The first test, they lost by an innings and more than 100 runs. I think they lost by an innings and 20-odd or something like that. So a whacking, but not as bad a whacking. That's really all you need to know about that. To be honest, this New Zealand team at home are really good. It's not necessarily a disgrace for the West Indies to be battered by this team. They're way better.
it's good to see Ross Taylor still playing as well. I think he'll play until I die, I reckon.
Maybe, yeah, the new Triscothic. should we quickly talk about Mushfiqur Rahim?
Yeah, so what happened here? He said that he punched one of his teammates?
So Mushfiqur Rahim, playing in the Bangladesh League, he was keeping wicket. The ex-captain of Bangladesh, a respectable cricketer, the ball goes up in the air, goes to a kind of fly slip area. Third man runs round to go and take the catch. Rahim runs to take the catch, and they minorly bang into each other when Rahim takes the catch. The ball isn't dropped. Rahim catches the ball. And then sort of immediately following the impact with whoever this third man fielder is, he raises his fist. And you know the famous football clip where Paolo Di Canio goes to punch Martin Keown? And then the referee falls over and it's hilarious. It's like that. It's one of those things that takes the cricket internet by storm, because that never happened. Nobody tries to punch someone, least for their own teammate, on a cricket pitch. But actually, it's not that big a deal. Again, similar to the Peter Siddle thing, worth looking it up because it is kind of funny, but doesn't necessarily come across that well on a podcast. Rahim, for his trouble, has been fined 25% of that match fee. And that's the end of the saga. Or we think. I mean, like, maybe in the next game he'll actually punch someone.
I'm starting to think of the background. What has caused him to react this way?
It's a good question.
What is the relationship between him and the third man? Is he the third man in a marriage that's gone wrong?
Who knows? I think the thing that happens afterwards is maybe more interesting, because you can see in the team huddle they're filming Rahim and he's like trying to justify. You can see he's trying to justify why it might have been reasonable to punch or to raise his fist to a teammate. He's gesticulating. You can kind of see all the other players being like, this guy's a bit intense. We need to keep fucking back here, lads. anyway, that's Rahim. England, should we do a quickly blast through England and then we'll get to Jared Kimber?
Yep, sounds good. So the England Test squad has been announced versus Sri Lanka for the upcoming Test series in January. Jofra Archer and Ben Stokes have been rested, whilst Burns is channeling his inner Virat Kohli and is staying home for the birth of his first child. Let's start with the selection of England. And I'm not going to touch upon Sri Lanka, because I don't know any of their players. They've picked six spinners, which is interesting, for the touring party. So I think they've picked every single spinner they possibly could do from England. But the big one is Moeen Ali is back.
Yes, I saw this.
So to go along with Don Best, Jack Leach, Crane, Parkinson and Verdi. Let's face it, Moeen's been a bit naff for quite a while now. So this is probably last chance hurrah for him.
I'm not actually sure that's a phrase. I think it's last hurrah, or last chance saloon. There's no last chance hurrah. Yeah. Which one of those do you want to go with? Then I can answer your question properly.
Let's go with the first one.
Last hurrah. I don't think it's the end of Moeen Ali for England. I think Moeen Ali will play at least until the end of the current T20 cycle, so the T20s. World Cup
this is for Test match cricket. I'm saying that if he's not going to be picked, he's not going to be picked to go to the Ashes, is he? Because you're not going to take Moeen Ali to Australia. You might take him to India.
I think they might.
Really?
Yeah. Well, they're going to India straight after Sri Lanka, so I think he's almost certainly going to be on the plane for that. I think if he bowls well, and he probably will get a chance in the Sri Lanka or the India series to play and bowl. Mm. If he bowls well in that and then gets back in the team for the summer, I don't think they'll drop him for Australia. I don't think the England team trust any of the spin options in county cricket. And I think they see Moeen Ali as a better option, if only because he can bat. And I think that's probably why Don Best played all seven tests this summer, or all six tests this summer. It's not necessarily because he's an amazing bowler. It's because at the very least they knew he was going to be able to bat a bit.
Well, let's hope that Moeen Ali finds himself like some soppy muppet on his gap year in Sri Lanka. They're going to pick two spinners. So who are you picking out of... the three are actually in the reckoning are Best, Leach and Moeen.
I think they might pick them all.
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah, because Stokes isn't playing, is he? So that frees up that position presumably for Moeen Ali. I don't think they're going to pick three seamers. So Wokes will probably drop out, which means you can pick Best, say... or Leach, and then they'll probably keep Best in the team. I imagine how they'll do it. I'd be really stunned if they had three seamers playing in all of those games. They might. I mean, the last time we were there, they played Anderson in one of the tests and Broad in one of the tests or something like that.
Yeah.
Curran played and didn't bowl in one of the games or something like that. It was a kind of confused thing, but basically they came to the conclusion, probably rightly on those pitches, that the maximum spin was the way to go. And so I think they'll do that again.
Brilliant. Okay, and then top of the order, with Burns at home with his child, Sibley and who is the question at the moment. So obviously Johnny Bairstow is back in the England squad because he never leaves, really, is he? He's always there. Zach Crawley kind of established himself as number three with his 267, was it, against Pakistan in the summer. What do you think is going to happen there? Do you think Crawley's going to be promoted?
I think they'll almost certainly promote Crawley. And then they will either play Bairstow at three or Dan Lawrence at three, but probably Bairstow at three. I don't really see why they'd have recalled him if they didn't expect to pick him. Although if they weren't going to pick him, they'd have just picked another prospect, wouldn't they?
Well, this is the thing. I'm surprised they've taken Joss Butler as well out of this, because obviously they've rested Archer, they've rested Stokes. Butler's been in the bubbles pretty similar to them as well. So I'm surprised they've taken Butler, especially as Folks is around and Bairstow he's fine. He's going to be in the squad. We might as well just accept that Johnny Bairstow is going to be an England player forever. So I think what do you think the order looks like? For me, you've got Dom Sibley, Crawley. I think Joe Root will actually bat three. Dan Lawrence will be at four. Joss Butler, five. I want them to play Folks. So maybe this is just me channeling my inner Max.
I think they have said they're not going to play. They're going to play Butler as wicketkeeper, which means there's not really much point in picking Folks.
I think he's a good.
I don't think the England team see it like that. If they thought he was a good enough batter to be in that team, I think he'd have played already. They've got, for some reason, they've decided he isn't. And I think it will be Bairstow and Butler and Moeen Ali coming in for Stokes.
Fair enough. Well, that leaves Ali at seven, Bess at eight, Broad and Wood at 9 and 10, and then your 11 is what, Leach or Anderson if they decide to go for a third.
Yeah, I suspect they'll rotate through those pace bowlers as well, won't they? Nobody wants to play three tests as a fast bowler in Sri Lanka. Yeah, that's England. Shall we move on to the interview? I mean, you're not with us for the interview, Ross, but would you like to move on anyway?
Yep. As I said, you should find us at The Cricket Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and really enjoy this interview. Jack, was he a great guest?
It was fantastic. Like I said, 15 minutes ago or something in the intro, we cover such an eclectic range of topics that there'll be something you'll be interested in, I have no doubt. And if you like cricket, probably lots of things you'll be interested in. anyway, we'll get on with that now. Today, we are joined by a man who's a filmmaker, author, podcaster, analyst, one-time general manager, blogger, and a YouTuber. Welcome to the podcast, the one and only Jared Kimber. How are you doing?
Well, I didn't have to say that intro, so I'm going fine.
We've got you on the show to talk about a range of Jared Kimber-themed topics. I think we'll start with probably your most recent podcasting work on your Double Century podcast. You've just completed the second season, which over five episodes told the story of Basil D'Oliveira and cricket's history with race. I think that's a good place to start. That's an interesting story. Can you tell us a little bit about Basil D'Oliveira and why his story is so important to the game?
Yeah, I think the first season of Double Century, I just did like individual episodes. So, you know, took a player or took a story or took a theme and sort of did it in 20 to 25 minutes. And when I got to the second season, I was thinking it'd be great to actually fully flesh out some of these topics a little bit more. And I was thinking what I need is something I can write up all in one go that I kind of know a little bit about. And I thought, well, Basil D'Oliveira kind of makes sense because you can't do it in one episode because his life was ridiculous and should not have existed. I mean, even if you use 1 minute for every year of his life, he probably was still playing Test cricket well into his 40s and still lying about his age. So there's a lot to cover there. And then while I started writing it, the Black Lives Matter movement happened and the NBA protests and George Floyd and all those sorts of things happened. And I thought maybe it is a better situation if I use my time to sort of match up what happened with Basil D'Oliveira to what has happened through the history of race in cricket, because it is such a weird thing. So Basil D'Oliveira is born in South Africa. He's Cape colored. That is not using colored as a racial slur. That's how they refer to themselves in that part of the world. And he was an extraordinary cricketer, we think, when he played club cricket in South Africa, because we don't know, because he wasn't allowed to play against anyone who didn't look like him. The closest he ever got back in those days to playing a really good standard of cricket is he was supposed to be playing against an unofficial West Indies team captained by Frank Worrell. And sadly, the South African government probably saw that coming and went, wait a minute, this could be bad PR. if all these black West Indians turn up and play against our black and coloured players. So no, we're not allowing that. Well, what we know is, and I suppose we know this now, is with Ashwell Prince and Vernon Philander, I mean, there's tons of them, Cape coloured cricketers are extraordinary and probably have been almost the backbone of South African non-white cricketers over the last, 10, 15 years. They keep finding incredible Cape coloured cricketers. So obviously that was a real hotspot for cricket, but because he wasn't allowed to play, we didn't know this. And all we knew was, if you look at the old records, you know, occasionally he would make 100 when the rest of the batsmen would make like minus seven in the innings around him, or he'd take all the wickets in an innings. And there was clearly this incredible talent, but he was going to become a printer because there was no money in him playing cricket in South Africa. And he just sent a bunch of letters to famous English people, really. Anyone of note, anyone posh, he probably sent a bunch to the MCC. I don't think we have access to all of his letters, but it sounds like he just went on a letter writing campaign as he was contemplating retirement. He was probably, my guess is, late 20s, early 30s at this point, realized he was at the peak of his game. And eventually those letters started to get filtered out across the UK. And one of them makes a club team in Lancashire who was supposed to be picking Wes Hall, but in, I think, maybe the biggest transfer moment in Lancashire history, Wes Hall doesn't end up playing for that team. He goes off to Accrington Stanley with Bumble, in fact. And so they need a replacement at the last minute, and they just take a flyer on this, I want to say, young South African, but they had no idea how old he was. They had no idea how good he was. Anyone who's ever played club cricket in England suddenly has an Afghanistani or an Australian guy who claims to have, been on the, virtually a first-class cricketer, and then they turn up to your club and you're just like, well, what, do you mean you played it once on EA Sports or something? That could have happened with Basil de la Vera. I mean, realistically, we didn't know that much about him. He hadn't been tested. No one knew what the standard was of this cricket he was dominating. He could have been dominating old ladies for all everyone knew. But he turns up and he plays cricket in Lancashire, and it's quite clear, I think within about 3 to 4 weeks, that he is a top-level talent. Starts dominating cricket in the Lancashire Leagues. And you got to remember, Lancashire Leagues, it's about as strong as club cricket could be, possibly ever, but certainly at that point.
Aren't there a couple of players who were playing as overseas in the Lancashire League around this time who basically went on to make test debuts or called up for their test team in England directly from Lancashire League cricket?
I mean, maybe not directly, but... I mean, I've already said Wes Hall. So Wes Hall goes on to be basically the prototype fast bowler. Before him, fast bowlers tended to be short. And before him, we hadn't really matched someone very quick with very tall who could hit you regularly. Jack Gregory was probably one of the few, Tom Richardson very early on, but we didn't really have fast bowlers. So when you think of what a fast bowler is now, Wes Hall is really where it all started. So he's playing club cricket in Lancashire, and he's the one that Basil obviously ends up replacing. So he was playing, but he'd already taken a bunch of test wickets. One of the other overseas pros was Sobers. So you get the idea of the talent that was in those competitions. So for Basil de la Vera to shine, and I think he outscored Sobers that year, if I remember, or maybe out-averaged him, and took an absolute truck of wickets. He obviously didn't end up being as good a bowler as Sobers, but his batting certainly stood up. And Sobers was in the peak of his game, whereas de la Vera was past his best and had never played that much cricket against good players. And then, of course, the next funny thing is that Lancashire is like, oh, he's a Sunday slogger. We don't see this guy as being a real cricketer because he played too attacking. So you ended up having to move to Worcester. In those days, you had to move to a county to play. I don't know if you know the story about the old Bart King, the old USA cricketer. He couldn't play county cricket because he didn't live in the UK. So he had to be offered some, apparently, and this is the story, and let's just go with it being true because it's great, that a widower who was a member at one of the county clubs offered to marry him so he could come over and play. And those stories aren't that rare. Like, that happened occasionally. Like, you would get a cricketer from Argentina, from Australia, from America, and you would be offered. But I think by the time Basil came along, he could move to Worcester. But he had to play in Worcester for like 3 years to qualify. It's just ridiculous, which obviously is an incredible situation to begin with. Anyway, in those 3 years, that's the period where everyone realizes how good he is. He starts playing first-class cricket games for a Commonwealth 11. He goes back to South Africa, plays against, I think, Zimbabwe, which was Rhodesia at the time, a few other games. But by this point, people can tell he's quite good. Starts off in county cricket, clearly a gun batsman. His bowling is... I don't know how old you guys are, but Mark Elam Light.
We're aware of Mark Elam. He's in the cricket conscience. I don't know if I could picture him or regale you with any tales of Mark Elam, but yeah. We're aware of the being that is.
Maybe Darren Stevens without the wickets would be maybe be another way of putting it. There's nothing wrong with Basil's bowling. In fact, he took some good county wickets, but I don't think you would have to spend much time looking at his bowling to go, that's probably not going to transfer to test level. He's probably not going to get a lot of wickets on the whack out bowling like that. I think he was probably a better bowler when he was younger. But by the time he makes, we're talking, he's at least mid-30s by the time he's a prospect, probably late 30s by the time he's a realistic prospect. Any bowling athleticism he had, I think probably left around the time he discovered alcohol in the UK and perhaps started to to swell slightly in the middle. I think he was
tale as old as time itself.
Exactly. But he could bowl. And anyway, so he goes on to play for England. Starts off incredibly. I think he averaged near 50 after 10 tests. But had a bit of a rough patch against the West Indies. And that all leads into he's got 5 tests against England in the UK to prove that he's good enough to play against South Africa. And that's kind of where everything goes to shit, because you then have a situation where clearly he's in England's best 15 prospects, and somehow he makes a very good score in the second innings against Australia when no one else could make runs in a very high chase. I think they were chasing 400. He comes in when they're about 5 for 100, makes a not out, bats very well, takes a couple of handy wickets as well, and gets dropped for the next test. And about this stage, it's quite clear that, I mean, now looking back on it, Peter O'Bourne's written a great book on it. There's been some other great historians take a look at it. It seems now someone got to the MCC from the South African government. We don't know the full details of it, but clearly there was pressure there. There was also just the normal gentleman pressure. You got to understand that people who were involved with the MCC at that time, who were picking the England team, they wanted to be able to go and enjoy themselves in Cape Town and Johannesburg and Durban and Port Elizabeth. They didn't want to go there and be attacked by, you know, political operatives and have themselves smeared in the newspapers and all that sort of thing. And then it was a really talented time for English cricket, but you got to remember how amateur everything was. There's some really good stuff about, they didn't know how fit the players were. Like, players were coming back from injury. They picked Basil de Oliveira. I mean, I've just said that I don't think he was a bowler, and he was picked as a frontline bowler in one of the tests against Australia. So if you picked someone who's not a very good bowler, if you picked Darren Stevens to bowl, if you picked Mike Yardy, he was probably more Mike Yardy as a seamer, I suppose, maybe might be a favorite thing. If you pick Mike Yardy to play in a test match as a seamer, as a frontline spinner, you're going to get what you expect from Mike Yardy. He probably won't go for many runs, but he's not going to take many wickets because he's Mike Yardy. And that's kind of where Basil's bowling was at that point. Then he gets dropped on the eve of the second test after everyone in the media talks down his previous test. And I go through that on the podcast. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that you would drop someone who was averaging 48 with the bat, who'd taken a couple of wickets with the ball from that previous test. He then goes off though. He's in terrible form, Basil, and he doesn't make any runs for ages. They have a squad for South Africa where you have to. So in those days, you basically had to say whether you were available, because not everyone was available, because some people had jobs. Some people didn't want to tour. Like, it was such a random thing. So literally the selectors would send you a letter and say, there'll be a test series at the end of the year. Good sir, would you be kindly enough to let us know your availability for said tour? And they never even contacted Basil after he was still averaging near 50. He could still bowl a bit. And he made, a not out, you know, 70 or 80 odd not out in his last test. So at this point, it would be hard to say that there wasn't politics involved. I've been lucky enough to talk to some of the journalists who were involved back in the day, and they basically said that they just listened to the powers that be, because the powers that be, you know, be selectors and MCC, had never really lied to them before. There would be no reason to, but the stakes had changed. And I think the journalists hadn't really understood that there was something different going on this time. Once he wasn't in, if you were a cricket journalist in that time and his name wasn't in the top 30, you'd have to be like, I mean, he's either slept with someone's wife or there's something, something rotten in Denmark here. So he doesn't get picked. It's quite clear he's not going to get picked for South Africa. But then there's a bunch of injuries. I can't remember now. You'd have to go back to the podcast. But I think England used something like 18, 19, 20 players in that series against Australia. And they're not getting smashed. They lose that first test that Basil played. But I think they draw the rest of the test. And they're just random guys are coming in, coming out. There's a few, there's some injuries. They're trying every all-rounder in the country that isn't Basil de Oliveira. What's his name? The guy with the fat ass, great bowler's ass from Lancashire, plays his last test. And he's got a test bowling average of 21 or something, plays one average test. They dump him. There's just lots of these sorts of weird. It was terrible selection from beginning to end. And that
doesn't sound like much change for 40 years either.
Well, I mean, if you go up until Darren Pattinson, it's basically up until Darren Pattinson that keeps happening in the And so then you get this weird situation where they have a couple of injuries, and Basil de Oliveira suddenly gets sort of brought into the team for the last test. Which doesn't make any sense, because they've already said he's not going to South Africa. You know, they've already decided that his county form, which was dire. I think he averaged 15 in 1 month. And you've got to remember, in those days, they played 150 county games every month. So, you know, he had plenty of opportunities. You know, it was a long period where he hadn't made any runs. He did keep taking wickets, though, randomly. Anyway, they decided, I think it was Cowdery decided, that they needed a all-rounder who could bowl a bit at the Oval. He played at the Oval earlier in the year, realised that the ball was nipping around a little bit, and that if they could get a bowling all-rounder in, eventually Basil De Oliveira doesn't even come in as the all-rounder. He comes in to replace a batsman because, and this is a story from Peter O'Bourne's book, which is great. I forget the name of the opening batsman. But the opening batsman had played one or two tests, realised he probably wasn't that good, and thought, if I pull out of this test, I'm a very good chance of being first pick selection for South Africa. That's how the story goes. I don't think we've ever had it confirmed, but it's a brilliant story, if for no other reason than that guy never played for England again after that.
Oh, it was a good plan.
Yeah. And so Basil comes in, they rejig the batting order. He then bats. It's a bit of a scrappy innings in some ways, but it's a bit of a scrappy innings where he makes 170 or 167.
Good enough for Dom Sibley.
Yeah, exactly. 159. I can't remember. It's a big score is my point. And of course, this makes everything so much weirder. So now, had he not played, England probably could have just said, he hasn't made a run in county cricket. We don't care. Had he not played, you could have said, look, you guys didn't complain when he wasn't in the 30 men that we contacted. He's not in our plans anymore. We think he's a good cricketer, but he's not there. There's plenty of normal cricket chat they could have done. But being that he just smashed 100 against Australia, the argument then becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. And he doesn't get picked for the squad. That is the first time that some journalists, obviously The Guardian and the sort of more left-leaning journalists start to go, there's something wrong here. I think CLR James, Lyra Constantine, the sort of socialist voices of cricket, as few and far between as they were back then, sort of stand up and go, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. I did big analysis on the squad. I think you could have made really good, strong arguments for him not being in the squad based on everything, if you wanted to. They had a bunch of old guys in the field, and Basil was... he's probably 41 by this point. And they had some guys that were just not fit at all. If you wanted a younger option, and of course the player that they ended up going for did go on to captain England, but he had failed in that same Ashes series. At least he would be able to run around in the field. They also went for another bowler who I did a deep dive on him. Very similar kind of bowler. He was never, Tom Cartwright was never going to take any wickets in South Africa. He'd played a test in South Africa before, hadn't taken wickets there before. He wasn't going to be, I wouldn't have thought he wouldn't have been a much better bowler than Basil anyway. And he wasn't as good a batsman as Basil. So, and Ken Barrington came back into the side. He's obviously an all-time great. So it makes sense that he was left out if you put it in that perspective. But the truth is that he wasn't in the original 30. They were never going to take him to South Africa anyway. That's the biggest slight there. Oops, shut up, phone. And then you're in a situation where Tom Cartwright pulls out. Now, this is, again, we don't have the full facts of this, and Tom Cartwright never really spoke up. Tom Cartwright at various times basically said he wasn't fit enough, that he didn't want to leave his son for a whole winter, that he had problems with the fact that Basil couldn't go in the first place and apartheid from a political standpoint. I reckon it's possibly a combination of all three. And he just thought, and he also might have just thought, I'm not going to take any wickets there. My bowling is useless in South Africa, which is what I would have thought if I was him. But I think it's a possibility that all those sort of things come together. He pulls out, and then suddenly Basil, who's not, and they just said Basil wasn't an all-rounder anymore. They were considering him only a batsman. Suddenly Basil then replaces a bowler in the side, which tells you everything that you kind of need to know. There was enough kickback from the press and the fans, I think, at that point, after they didn't select him. He then, of course, he is selected, and straight away the South African president calls off the tour. President or Prime Minister, I should remember that, but I can't remember half the names in this. Anyway, the tour is cancelled. It becomes a very, very big thing. It basically becomes the impetus for South Africa being kicked out of cricket. Now, what I talk about in the podcast is that Australia still toured there after that. There was supposed to be another tour to Australia after that. There was the Women's World Cup. They tried to host one of them in South Africa in the 70s. And before that, South Africa didn't play against the West Indies, India, or Pakistan because, you know, of the whole, they didn't have enough white people in their team. which would be 11, I suppose, for South Africa at that point.
Yeah.
So realistically, Basil was kind of in the middle of all this, and I suppose that's why I thought it was such a good story, in that he very much tells you the story of race in cricket. But it's not a straightforward, it's not as straightforward as you would believe race in cricket to be. You would believe in a conservative sport run by the sorts of people who would listen to South African politicians of that time, that it would be, yeah, cricket was racist, 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 slightly less racist now. And that's not how it was. You know, you had players of darker skin playing for South Africa. You had a black West Indian play for Australia. You had Indians play for England. It was a very, very confusing. You know, the West Indies being, you know, ratified as a team, we're having 7, 8, 9 black players playing for them at times, even if they had the white captain. It's a really mixed messages throughout cricket of just like, well, if you're good enough and you can sell us tickets, we'd probably get you involved. And then occasionally you get the absolute opposite, where you get Indigenous cricketers from Australia all being called for chucking, which is quite handy that all Indigenous players seem to chuck when they bowl. And then you get other, events like, you know, what happened with South African cricket. Originally, you know, Ranji struggling to play for England. I just thought it was a really, if you compare it, American sport seems to have basically said nothing. It was just all white, and then we let one black guy in and then we fixed everything. Cricket was never like that. It just goes up and down and across. And the fact that Don Bradman has to be convinced to not let South Africa tour after Basil D'Oliveira is just an incredible moment, really. And it's not just you know, the white players either. Obviously, West Indies sent two rebel tours to South Africa. Garfield Tober said he would have played cricket in South Africa. He played in Rhodesia. You know, so the whole sport had this sort of really interesting thing. And then, in the future, I'll probably make an episode about West Indies cricket. It's been one of the most racist cricket cultures between Asian players and black players at times. And I thought that Basil D'Oliveira allowed me to talk about a few different things, you know, the sort of the gentleman aspect of cricket. You know, I'm going to write a lovely man in England and hopefully one of them will let me play. And, oh, I'm really good at playing cricket in England, but I can't play for that county because I'm a slogger. Now I'm going to have to play for another county, but I'm going to have to sit there for 3 years to prove myself. So it's an incredibly interesting story. And, you know, to be honest, to do the entire history of race in cricket over 5 episodes is not exactly...
5 series, maybe.
Yeah, 5 series. I mean, it would be a huge book if you were to write that book. But I wanted to give a flavour of how inconsistent and how crazy this day, you know, if you're listening to a commentary and Kuldeep Yadav comes on, someone is still going to call him a Chinaman, despite the fact that in 1933 in a Yorkshire newspaper, everyone went, just so you're all aware, guys, this is a racist term. And cricket is still using it, you know, almost 90 years later. So good times.
Yeah, I mean, just very quickly, where do you think we are now on the race thing? Because obviously it's the series you put together is quite poignant in terms of what's going on in the world at the moment. So it would be interesting to get a quick take on where you think cricket stands on race. You know, obviously there was the issue with South Africa deciding not to take the knee in the recent England series. I suppose in comparison with other sports, perhaps.
I mean, incredible that South African cricket of all places would not take a knee. I know that some of the players did. I think they probably made a mistake. I think the West Indian players have had enough. I think their treatment over the years, I think they're so sick and tired of casual racism, the West Indian players. So things like their natural cricketers, when they're probably the smartest T20 players we've ever had. And I think that, you know, there's still a lot of things... There's a really interesting thing. There's a charlatan who works in India, who's his name is Sadhguru. And I know that sounds like I'm taking a piss, but that's literally his name. He did a thing on cricket not that long ago where he said the difference between Virat Kohli and Viv Richards was that Viv Richards wasn't very driven as a person. He was very laid back and he didn't have strong held beliefs. Whereas Virat Kohli was a strong, proud Indian man. And I was just like, are we still saying things like that? And I
think, same old tropes.
Yeah. And I think I think Virat is one of the most driven cricketers I've ever come across. I'm not sure he's more driven than Viv Richards, though. I'm not sure he's more passionate about his community than Michael Holding is, or that many West Indian than Jason Holder is either. So,
I mean, Viv Richards batted without a helmet to make a statement about how unafraid of the opposition he was. That's not really a laid-back approach. That's about as confrontational as you can be.
He choked people in the change room for being racist against him. He wore Rasta bands. I mean, I think we know where his, you know, and so the fact that that's still there and that sort of still exists, I think shows we've got a long way to go. I think that a lot of cricket's problem is that it's not, if you look at South Africa, and I'm doing a big project on this at the moment that will come out shortly, but Cricket South Africa had the quota system, which is to help with racial problems. The bigger problem within South African cricket is not a racial problem. It's a class problem, in that all their cricketers come from one particular class, which is if you can afford to or be found and thrown through a posh school, you're going to play cricket for South Africa. It doesn't matter if you're white or black. If you don't go to a good school, the chances are that unless you're related to another cricketer or you're Pakistani, you're not going to play cricket for South Africa. So that is a huge problem, and that is not a problem just in South Africa. That is right across the board. You know, there are whole states of India that have never produced first-class cricketers, you know, in the East, because they're not seen as ethnically Indian in the same way that the rest of Indians are. So there's a huge problem right across sport and England, sorry, right across cricket that England has. It's not just a race problem that cricket is fighting. I think there's a class problem, and there's also a we have this inherent thing in cricket where we think that people only play the sport if we always know that they've played the sport. So Ireland can't be a cricket nation to us because we don't know that Ireland played cricket, despite the fact that Ireland have a 250-year history with cricket, right? Despite the fact that the USA don't do cricket, despite the fact that they have one of the longest international histories with cricket. So it's not just a race problem. We have this way of dividing in cricket, which probably comes from, you know, the colonial natures of the sport where, you know, women can't play, ethnic people can't play, poor people can't play. This country doesn't play because they're not part of the Commonwealth. And I think we have learnt now that it is absolute nonsense, but we maybe don't have these structures all the way through the sport. So it's not so much that we have a problem with race. It's that the ICC isn't finding a way to make Brazilian women's cricket incredibly the most important story in the world. I mean, no, every cricket writer in the world, you guys, ICC should be contacting you with like representatives from Brazilian cricket and Thai cricket and, you know, Nepalese cricket and saying, can you talk about all these people over and over again? Here's our captain, you know, here's our coach. Here are people involved. So it's not even just race. We have this way in cricket of dividing everyone into haves and have nots, and they're proper cricket people and they're not proper cricket people. And so you then throw normal everyday life racism on top of that, and everything gets more messy. But that's the brilliant thing about cricket, is it's always fucking shambolic.
Well, the word shambolic brings us quite nicely, actually, onto, governance, I suppose. you're quite familiar with the subject, having brought out a film, Death of a Gentleman, about ICC governance. And we spoke with Dan Norcross last week, and he had a few ideas about how we might arrange the Test cricket calendar, obviously in the shadow of comments recently about the World Test Cricket Championship and whether it should go on. How would you see the Test calendar being arranged, sort of to get the most out of Test cricket for, well, all nations, I suppose?
Essentially, it needs to be a league. It needs to be a promotion and relegation league, and the league then has to sell the rights as one whole package. And out of those rights, you pay the players and the coaches and the umpires and the facilities fees to all the different countries around the world. And then we have guaranteed 10 to 20 years of Test cricket, no matter how much the interest drops off it. Any other system that anyone comes up with will struggle with the very basic thing of, why would a young West Indian cricketer spend all of his time developing himself to play Test cricket? There's no reason. Why would a young Sri Lankan cricketer do it? Why would a young Afghanistani cricketer do it? You first thing you need to do is make sure that all Test cricketers are paid correctly, and that they are still thinking it is a viable income for them. And the second thing is that you cannot sell individual rights. TV boards will screw you over every chance they have. If you're trying to sell New Zealand West Indies to Sky, Sky didn't even show it.
No, it's on YouTube.
Yeah. Sky just eventually just went, it's not worth it. It's not worth it for us to do that. Sky aren't in that situation if it's all sold as an entire package. It's just like, do you want the Ashes? Well, then you have to buy every single bit of cricket in the world, right? That is where the future is. Obviously, cricket TV which will be, you know, like NBA TV or MLB TV in the future, is where they should be going. But they can't even do that until the ICC owns the rights. Once you get to that point and the ICC starts saying, okay, well, a player from Bangladesh, you know, their top-ranked player will make $700,000 a year. And a player from Australia, their top-ranked player will make $700,000 a year. And anyone in Division One gets this amount of money and this sort of thing. There's nothing to stop Cricket Australia still paying the players for their image rights on top of that. There's nothing to stop Cricket Australia saying to Mitchell Starc, we're going to give you an extra $2 million on top of this because we don't want you to play IPL or the 100. All those things are still on the table for the rich boards if they want to do it. But what that allows for is the ability for Test cricket to always be worth money. You shouldn't be playing Test matches where you're losing money, and boards are still doing that. If that continues to happen, people just won't play Test cricket anymore. That's how we solve the problem. Now, the reason this won't happen is the boards would have to, well, basically the three main boards would have to make slightly less money. Although I would argue they will make far more money into the future doing this sort of plan, but they would have to make slightly less money in the short term. And they would have to let the ICC organize things. And they don't really want the ICC management organizing anything. And that's where all this falls down. So instead of doing that, we will continue with the, you know, fucking shambolic nature of how cricket is run, where you have T20 leagues where players don't get paid. You have test matches where no one turns up and no one even pays for the rights. You have players who are looking at the game and going, why would I ever play for my country when I can play, when I can make somewhere between 50 and 100 times more playing for a franchise? And until that changes, we're going to continue to have our problems.
Do you think anyone actually has the vision to make that happen within the existing governance structures of cricket? Because, I mean, at the moment, I mean, the BCCI is going to make money, probably far into the future. The ECB is going to make money whilst Test cricket is viable, and because of the Ashes, they've got a context to build their Test schedule around, so they'll be able to make money for at least a decade, probably more. And Cricket Australia probably do as well, although they seem to kind of have some management issues that mean that they end up losing money in the end. But they do have a product that is sellable to TV companies or broadcasters. How do you bring those people to the table to talk about how you save Sri Lankan cricket or West Indian cricket, or how you make them viable as
Well, I think the easiest way is to basically go to those guys and go, if Sri Lanka can't afford to play you, so if you look at it from a total point, when I talk about the rights packages, right? India need Sri Lanka, West Indies, New Zealand, Zimbabwe, South Africa, two of them, because they make an absolute buttload of money when they play those teams. And unless they're going to do a 12-month IPL or an 8-month IPL, they're going to have to find other ways to make income. You can't just play England and Australia over and over again, because it would devalue the content that you're eventually pushing. So what you say is, realistically, cricket had its biggest growth with the most teams that were playing it, right? If you continue to say that you will do bilateral agreements with these teams are just going to keep sinking. If you want Sri Lanka to find the next Murali, and if you want New Zealand to continue to punch above their weight, and you do because you want better TV products, you want to be able to beat the other teams, you want them to actually do something, then it will make more money in the long run. India is still going to be the richest team. England's still going to be the second richest team, and Australia's still going to be the third richest team. No, there's no scheme I can come up with that would stop those three things from happening, right? Because they're the three biggest media markets. So the best thing to do is, doesn't everyone want to make more money from this? So that in the future, I put it this way, if I had them at the table, I'd be like, in 10 years' time, you don't know if half these test teams are going to be playing test cricket, which means that you can't make money off them because you make an absolute fortune from putting a test match on England, Australia, or India on the TV. It makes a fortune.
Yeah, I think we're probably in agreement. I mean, the only thing I wonder, and this is sort of a trend in the way people watch sports, actually. I wonder if the ECB, for instance, would pay Sri Lanka to play test matches against them, and knowing full well that they're not going to be a contest and that England will batter them, just to put out a product which might not bother many England fans. But I think there's a trend, probably most observable in football, actually, that people watch the game, more people watch the game if there are more goals, regardless of who is scoring the goal. So people aren't watching Barcelona v Eibar because they want Barcelona v Eibar to be a contest. They want to see five goals. And if they're all scored by Barcelona, it doesn't matter. And I wonder if people would watch England v Sri Lanka's annual test, or annual test 11, and watch that pumping and not really care from an English broadcasting point of view.
I can say is, looking at numbers online, close test series and interesting test series trump.
I mean,
Australia is one of the few markets I would say that's different, but that is because the Australian cricket fans are more like football fans anyway than I think other cricket fans are. I don't think that's a viable long-term.
No, I agree. Model. I would completely agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, I see what you're saying, but realistically, if you're going to pay them to come out, why not actually set up a situation where you're helping support their cricket and grow? The thing about international cricket is that it is a collective of all these organizations together, right? If you have an opportunity to save them and to build them and grow them. So the way I look at it from an IPL point of view is that if I'm running the IPL, I want the next AB de Villiers. He is a marketable asset, and I want the next Andre Russell, and I want all those people. How do I set it up so that that next Andre Russell actually picks cricket and is available, and he gets picked up by a talent scout when he's 12, and at 15 gets good coaching in Jamaica or whatever it is? Now, they might be able to do that by doing doing like football academy style things. They might be able to do it that way, but there's a really easy other way to do it, which is actually fund the national bodies without you really losing any money.
Yeah.
You don't even have to spend your own money. There is a way of doing that. Those are such good. South Africa and West Indies. And how many Sri Lankan T20 stars have there been in the last 10 years, right? There've been none. And that's because they haven't had their own league. Let me tell you, they have some of the most talented T20 players. They've got that young leg spinner who's coming through, the all-rounder at the moment. They had Shanaka, who should have been smashing attacks all around the world. They had, you know, a couple of Kusals who would have been really good T20 players as well. They have the talent, but because there was no league there to develop it, that means it didn't get to the major leagues. You need to be in a situation where that doesn't happen. And I just think that if you can help fund all these bodies, and I would be doing the same with associate cricket, how much goodwill and good press does the Big Bash get out of every time they find another player in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Nepal? So that is part of your narrative at this point. Keep going. The NBA does all these things because the NBA understands it. They understand how these things work. And because no one's in charge of cricket, it's not that there are idiots working at the ICC that don't know this. The people who run the ICC on a day-to-day basis, they're sitting there pulling their hair out going, oh my God, we have a Nepalese pinup star here. Let's do something with him. Let's get these people out there. And no one's doing anything with them. And I think that is what the problem is. If you can prop up the test playing nations first, and then secondly, the second best 10, 15 teams under that, you're in a completely different situation then. And you should be able to guarantee the income of test cricket, of one day cricket for a long time forward, make the quality of cricket better. And then all the really rich leagues will steal those players for their own leagues.
or at the least you've got a more marketable product because the next Muralitharan is playing against you. Sri Lanka were box office in the UK for the early 2000s because they had Muralitharan.
People are still talking about Wacker and Mosin from the 90s. Do you know what I mean? People remember those sorts of things in cricket culture. And football is a different sport, to be fair, you know, in many different ways. But I do understand what you're saying. But I just think that cricket is different because it's an international sport and you end up with those rivalries over a point. So, you know, Rabada versus Jofra is going to be a thing for 10 years. That's going to be a really interesting relationship. And, you know, Rabada's already pissed off that Jofra gets more, better publicity than him. So the next time he plays England, he's going to try and fucking nut everyone, isn't he? So we have those kinds of things in cricket. We have, everyone hates England. So there's that whole England thing. But then you have these individual rivalries on these different levels. And I just think that you would be silly to give that up because that is the reason that Test cricket has continue to this point. So if you let it phase off and you just pay, and if you pay Sri Lanka to bring out a development squad every time and they all get smashed in the face, I just think that is what could kill Test cricket more than this other plan that I've come up with, which wouldn't make anyone poorer and would actually probably ultimately make everyone richer and everyone better. But they won't do it because they would have to give up power.
I think that's quite a good summary.
Yeah, very comprehensive. A long way to go, I think, for the people managing cricket to get it right. But yeah, maybe with your large dossier on their desk, things could change. One aspect where cricket has actually come on quite a lot in the last 10 years or so is in analytics, which is another subject close to your heart. And I listened to you on the Effectively Wild podcast last year, and it was interesting listening to you describing different aspects of cricket, especially relating to analytics, to people who pretty much had no idea about cricket. And that actually made cricket, to someone who knows cricket, sound completely fucking insane. Like, how ridiculous is cricket as a sport?
So I think Cricket Australia didn't get involved with analytics for a long time. India had some incredible people like Venki, and Nathan Leeman got involved with England, and Cricket Australia didn't have a full-time analyst at all. They had a video analyst, and they were taking stuff for free from a guy called Krishna Tunga, who's this incredible guy. He sent me three emails while I've been talking to you.
Prolific.
Yeah, once he gets on a roll on something, he's just an incredible human being. So they didn't have anything. So they basically went out and outsourced it. Recently, they got involved with Google cricket fans who worked at Google and just said, what can you come up with? But before that, they actually hired a company, and the company came in, and the company straight away, the first thing they said was, Test cricket is, we're going to call it the monster. It is so hard to analyze Test cricket because there are so many different facets to it, and there is so... You know, a third day pitch at the Wacker is, you know, a different species of a third day pitch to something in Guyana. A first day pitch in those two places aren't even the same sport at times. You know, and once you start to look into deterioration and the way that different wickets deteriorate, the way that different balls deteriorate, the way that dew comes in certain places and doesn't come in.
I think that was my favourite bit, actually, when you were saying you can have the dew factor in the evening, which means sometimes certain bowlers can't bowl. But then you can also have it in the morning if the game starts early. And it's just like, tell that to someone who doesn't like cricket. You can see why it puts people off.
Yeah, I mean, when you start to factor in all those sorts of things, it's crazy how many different layers there are to cricket and how you put them in. So really good example. So Dan Christian, he's a baseball fan, and he'll talk to me about analytics a bit, but he always holds back. And one thing I'll put up an article, and then about 3 days later, I'll get a message from him going, if he's mentioned it, especially, I'll get a message from him going, yeah, but you know why I do that. And it's like, so the last one was, I think I had him as one of the slowest scorers against spin in the world in T20 cricket. And he goes, yeah, but I'm just holding my wicket to the end. And I'm like, but mate, you can also bash spinners, just bash spinners as well. But you have to understand that in his head, he's thinking, I can score up 20 runs and over off seam bowling for the last four overs. That's how Dan Christian thinks. And to be fair, he's done it a few times. So who's to question him at this point? My point is, yeah, but mate, you can also score at 15 runs and over off spin for the four overs before that. And so he's still thinking about from that point of view. So when you, I remember talking to someone about, I want to say Ollie Rayner. No, who's the Kent off spinner? You guys should know, from a couple of years ago. Oh God, why have I forgotten his name? Anyway, he had a good couple of years. And I was saying to Gareth Batty when we were working for TalkSport, I was saying, what happened to this guy? Like, you look at his numbers for a couple of years there, he did really well. And he goes, do me a favor, check if those were the years he played with Doug Bollinger. And I was like, the fuck's that got to do with anything? Doug's not fucking helping him. And he goes, left arm. And the minute he said it, it completely came together. And I suddenly understood what he was saying. Essentially, he was suggesting that the couple of years that this guy had been good at off spin happened to overlap with the fact that Doug Bollinger was giving him footmarks to bowl into every game. And Doug Bollinger is not just a left arm seamer, but a heavy footed left arm seamer. He's a big, heavy guy, but he also hits the wicket very hard. You know, you've got Jimmy Anderson type guys who run in, and then you've got Doug Bollinger guys who dig a trench. It didn't quite overlap, but the point is that you could easily pick an off spinner. Like some off spinner you've got in your team, right? And you in county cricket, and he takes 80 wickets one year and 70 wickets the next year, and you go, this guy is great. Let's get him straight into the team. And you don't look at the fact that you know, he's got two left arm seamers that he's been bowling at the other end, and he's just been ripping in the wickets because he's been bowling into footmarks from almost day one. Factoring that into a fucking algorithm is like, do you know what I mean? And then what about if the one wicket doesn't get footmarks? Do you know what I mean? Like, as well, it's not just as simple as how that works. And then Wayne Parnell, my guess is, and I'm just throwing this out there, my guess is Wayne Parnell doesn't create the same kind of footmarks that Dougie Bowler does, right? So you straight away, you've got all these different things to think about. And we're not even close to that yet. CricViz is, it's growing at least, but CricViz is maybe 15 or 20 people. When Moneyball, by the time Sabermetrics and Moneyball came along, you're talking about thousands of people going through this and everyone going off in their own little directions. We don't have access to Hawkeye data. Most people don't have access to ball-by-ball data unless they know how to source it. And so there's probably a collection of 150 to 200 people in the world looking at this sort of stuff at the moment. And the most interesting data is Hawkeye data, and we don't have that. The second most interesting data will be spatial tracking, and no cricket grounds do that yet. So we're not even at the level where we can get to where basketball and the NFL and baseball is. And we have a more complicated game because I think, to paraphrase Nathan Lehman talking about all of Graham Swann's problems is, if you can't tell me what the pitch is going to do, what's the fucking point of view? And that's kind of true. We can't tell a player exactly what the pitch is going to do. And I had a situation with St. Lucia where I went around and asked all the local players and groundsmen, is this pitch going to change? We've played here for two games. Is it going to change? Absolutely no way will it change. The last two games, we had scored 210 and 230 or something, right? Huge scoring pitch. We lost one of those games. So another team scored over 200 against us to chase. And I think even the other game, the team made some runs. Absolutely no point. The pitch is not going to change. I go to the meeting and say, I've talked to all the locals. The locals tell me the pitch won't change. Darren Sammy tells me the pitch is not going to change. We're going to trust Darren Sammy. We'll go out there and we will roll for 80. Now, I'm not saying those guys were wrong and the groundsman was wrong, but it could have just been we got rolled for 80 for whatever reason. But try going back to the players with a straight face for the next game after that has happened. You've done all the research. Everything is right as far as you can tell. But the grass is a living organism. It doesn't give a shit about your research in a way that baseball parks and basketball stadiums and NFL stadiums, we know even when there are variables within those stadiums, and we know there are better stadiums to hit home runs in, and we know there are better stadiums to run the ball and throw the ball and all those different sports, but the fucking grass doesn't change it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it literally doesn't change it. And that's where we are, and that's why it's so complicated.
To sort of follow up on that a little bit then, so some teams are looking into this, and I think probably most notably England, because I think they are the team that are most ensconced in the CricViz Hawkeye ball tracking analytics community, if you like. Is there anything they have tried that has actually worked? Because you wouldn't know on the just looking at results over the last decade, say, that England have what appears on the face of it to be a significant advantage over at least some of their competitors. Or have they in fact actually been a lot more successful than it appears or that it feels from an England fan's point of view?
But they won a World Cup after.
Oh, they did win the World Cup. I meant that to frame that in the context of Test cricket, the monster. Obviously, we can see the developments in the one day team, and maybe that's where they focus their energy, because as you say, there's only 15 people working on this, or maybe 20, and maybe that was the decision they made to look at the white ball game over.
They certainly, it's a tricky one. I think their plans are really good to opposition batsmen. But that's a hard one to tell because you would have to see what they were going to bowl beforehand. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But I
there's no counterfactual, basically.
It's very rare I'm watching England bowl to a batsman in Test cricket and I'm like, why are they doing this? So, for instance, when they bowled to Faf du Plessis in the Test match, they bowled exactly where an analyst would want them to bowl. It wasn't, Faf wasn't doing very well. It would be easy. If a batsman's not doing well, you generally start to bowl more at the stumps because you think he's going to miss more. If they would have done that, Faf would have just whipped a bunch of balls off the pads for four. They kept it outside off stump, and that's where he went out almost every time. They very early on, they worked out that Rassie van der Dussen had a weakness to the left arm seam, and Sam Curran would be brought on over and over again. There's only one game I could think of, one time he batted where that didn't happen. As far as bigger tactics, I think you have to look at the fact that they are trying to build a lineup where they have six bowling options and back to eight or nine. I don't know how much that is Nathan Lehman, Andy Flower thinking, and how much that is, well, we actually have a pretty good crop of all-rounders, so why not develop into that. But what I do know is it was definitely part of the plan for white ball cricket. If we can bat to 9, 10 or 11, that gives everyone freedom to bat the way that we want them to. Me and George Nobel fight about this all the time. He's like, oh, there's no analytics in the white ball 10. They just told them all go out and bash it. And I'm like, you can go out and bash it if your number 11 has scored 10 first class hundreds. Like there's a theory about the way they do it. And they didn't all go out and bash it. Morgan and Root purposely came up with a plan to score at 6 runs and over without losing wickets in the middle overs, which allowed the openers to go as hard as they wanted and then allowed everyone to slog at the end. And I think there are probably parts to that to Test cricket, but Test cricket doesn't work on that kind of level. Like, what analysis can you give Johnny Bairstow to the fact that every time someone bowls on the stumps, he's probably going to go out? You know what I mean? It takes me back to a really interesting conversation I had with George Munsey, the who was supposed to be in the 100 this year, the Scottish slogger. He's going to hate that I called him a slogger. But he's a slogger, a brilliant slogger, incredible hitter. And he was just like, you know, what can you help me with? And I said, just hit more sixes, man. And he's like, I already hit a lot of sixes. Yeah, hit more. There's a certain point where analysis doesn't help. And what could I say to Bairstow? Don't go out when the ball's straight. So I think there are little things like that. I think they're very good at their planning. I think they're also very good at working out individual roles for different bowlers. So the biggest problem with bowling in the history of the game is you end up with 3 opening bowlers in every team and you can't use 3 opening bowlers. And I think they're much better at working out what a first change bowler is. And then, going into the future, you know, they are much better at going England-style bowlers. So Chris Wokes, for instance, do not translate to overseas conditions. So Chris Wokes has to become a different bowler overseas, or we can't use him in that particular situation. I think all those little things, they're starting to come about. Now, some of these are not maybe massive analysis stuff, but because they're looking at the game on a deeper level, they're looking for role players and ways that players fit in. I think one of the other things is, if you actually go back to when they won in 10, 11, around that period when they were, you know, when they went past South Africa as the best team in the world, they were very clearly at that point playing a very simple money ball system that I don't think they got enough credit for, which is, if our top 3 can take 200 balls out of the innings and we have a strong middle order and our bowlers all go at under 2.5 runs and over, we can control the entire tempo of the game. So if you go back, you know, you had Strauss and Cook and Trott. Those 3 at the top allowed them to control it. And then you could throw in Bell and Pryor and KP and Flintoff when he was around and just go, you guys, just do what you do. We're gonna try and make sure when you're in the crease, you've either got someone solid at the other end or you're already free to play your natural game, which meant that KP is now facing tired bowlers. And it's a very simple thing, and it is taken from the walks in baseball, essentially. But instead of saying to their top order batsmen before, you know, we want you to make this many runs, I think they started to look at it from a more point of, we want you to bat this much time. They have used that again recently. They have vehemently denied it publicly, even though
I don't want anyone else catching on, do they?
But it's really weird that they. So I basically said that they had a 100 ball plan. That they said to these guys, we want you to face 100 balls each. Don't worry about how many runs you make. And Joe Denley has recently come out and said that that's not the case. We're going to have to agree to disagree on that. but the plan, again, is a very simple thing to go back to that. But you also need the cattle to be able to do that. They had that plan for about 6 years beforehand. And then they were, oh, fuck, this isn't going to work. So they tried Alex Hales, and he batted slower than Alistair Cook, hilariously. And so it's all well and good to have that plan. But in Test cricket, because your individual weaknesses are shown so much more, you can have all the great analysis in the world. If Johnny Bairstow can't hit the ball when they're bowling on the stumps to him, eventually he's going to miss a ball when it's on the stumps and he's going to be out LBW. So I think that there are parts of it that we can learn. I think England tried to bowl more, bowl first more. They certainly have back. I mean, ancient cricket wisdom would tell you that you shouldn't use an all-rounder unless they are bang on for one particular position in the team as a batsman or a bowler. I think England have stretched that as far as they could stretch it. And I reckon that is probably an analysis-led theory. They may or may not be wrong. I think if you have 6 bowling options, that works. Probably doesn't work if you have 5 bowling options, but it probably does work if you have 6 bowling options. So I think there are little things that they are doing there. But realistically, there is a certain point in Test cricket where it works so differently than limited overs. Limited overs works like basketball.
It's an efficiency game, I think, is how you described it on that podcast, which whereby both teams have got 120 opportunities to maximise the number, the amount of the resource that they're trying to accumulate in a T20 match, for instance.
And Test cricket just doesn't work in that way in any way, shape or form. In T20 cricket, especially, you're hunting the bowlers. In Test cricket, the bowlers are hunting the batsmen. There's a certain, if you think about it from a very certain perspective, if you're facing a bowler who is putting the ball on the same line and length over and over and over again, you have a limited amount of options that you can actually use against them in Test cricket. But if you want to talk about analysis, have a look at the fact that when Vernon Philander or Mohammad Abbas is bowling, sometimes Jason Holder, watch what Ben Stokes and Jos Buttler do. They change the length. That is probably come from a conversation between the coaches, between the analysts, maybe even between the players and the analysts of what do we do? What can we do? And so you looking at home probably just think, well, it's just because Buttler and Stokes want to taught the slow bowler, right? But the reality is that someone like Nathan Lehman or Mo Babbat or whoever's working with them basically going, you cannot let this guy bowl to you. If you let this guy bowl to you, he will get you out. You have the ability to change the length, you know, and whether you do that, some batsmen do that by batting a meter out of the crease one ball and a meter behind the crease the next ball. Other batsmen do it by walking at the bowler. Anything that this guy can do to upset the bowler. I think little things like that, England do a lot of little things like that that you can notice. I think I said about before they won the World Cup that they were the most interesting team in cricket to watch because they have so many different styles to them and they have the ability to be utterly shithouse as well, which, you know, you know, in Test cricket, they when they're playing good, you're just like, how could they ever lose a game again? And then when they start to lose, you're just like, they might lose five on the trot here. But their ability to sort of and they won't. They'll end up 2-all in that series that you've said both of those opinions. And they have this incredible sort of way of veering. And partly it's because of all those all-rounders, but they're incredibly interesting. They do a lot of very tiny things in a different way. You know, up until Nathan Lehman doing the gesturing in the one days the other day, they are constantly thinking. But essentially, cricket was not made to be analysed in the way that it is. So, I mean, me and Nathan probably have wanted to use that system a long time. He's probably had to convince Owen Morgan and Sean Massoud so much because cricket is not ready for that yet. And realistically, I think that one of the most jobs is something that isn't used enough in cricket, which is after every game, having a sounding board that isn't the coach and the player comes off and you go through the innings and go, this is what you did in this innings. An analyst job can be that simple. And I would hope that that is where the England position is at the moment. And then you've got all the cool little tricks on top of that.
Yeah. I think we've gone through analytics in a fair amount of detail there and we're up to about an hour now. So I think we've got a few more bits on T20 cricket because you actually have been involved on the inside as well as speculating there on what the England team may do with their test side. You were the general manager at St Lucia Zooks, or was it St Lucia Stars at that point?
St Lucia Stars. I've got a St Lucia Stars and an Edinburgh Rock shirt, of which one day I will sell both of them on eBay and retire.
Firstly, I think from a fan's point of view, being the general manager of a sports team sounds like it would be fantastic. I'm not sure, based on what you've said on other podcasts and what you've written, whether it turned out to be the dream that I imagine it would be. Can you talk us through a day in the life of, or a week in the life of, a general manager of a team like St Lucia?
It's the most satisfied I've ever had having a job in cricket. I think it played to all of my strengths as someone, you know, when you went through the 4,000 jobs that I've had in cricket before, it was a chance to almost use all of them and everything I knew about cricket. The owner was an absolute nightmare who was terrible in almost every conceivable way. So that's not ideal. It's always worse when you got a shit boss at anything.
Fair enough.
The situation wasn't ideal. I went there to be the general manager to work. Sorry, I went there to be the assistant general manager and the analyst with the team to work under a guy called Muhammad Khan, who me and Muhammad wanted to go ahead and run T20 franchises together. I ended up replacing Muhammad, who was my friend. That's awkward and shit as well, but someone has to take over a franchise in the middle of a tournament. But And you also, you, and then your phone just does not stop calling. Agents, players, coaches, the press, you know, CPL people. I was getting upwards of 40 to 50 emails a day, probably double that again in WhatsApps. My, you know, as I said, my phone just never stopped calling. And it was a very amateur situation. And it was amateur when I was the analyst, so I knew what I was getting into when I took over as general manager. But I think it was still a great job. I don't think it is. It's not. I think other people see it as a job where you are a bit like if you run a fantasy sports team, you think it's like that. It's not like that when the player comes up to you and says, "My trousers don't fit because they shrunk in the wash."
It's not a Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like running a fantasy team when you're worried about the fact that your hotel has a casino in it and you have, you know, young impressionable players that you don't want to be in the casino at 3 a.m. Mm. It's not like a fantasy job when ACSU is calling you about details of games to see, you know, to make sure nothing went wrong. It's not, you know what I mean? Like there's a lot going on. Also, St. Lucia is an interesting cricket market in that it's not a cricket market. Outside of Darren Sammy, there was no huge cricket beforehand. Darren Sammy has almost made cricket a thing in St. Lucia by being Darren Sammy. So trying to get local media involved and trying to get fans into the grounds and all those sorts of things. And, you know, trying to get the local news anchor to get interested in our younger players and meeting the family of younger players and saying, "Look, I'm probably going to draft this player this year, but he's not ready. But I need a St. Lucian player to be on my squad in case Darren gets injured. And also because Darren is old and Darren may even want to retire and become a coach for all I know. I need a young player. So if we draft your player, your son and your nephew, let me be very clear. He may not play an entire game, but this is what we're going to do for him. And this is, I know he's studying at university and this is how we're going to help him. And this is how we're going to teach him how to be a professional." Those sorts of things you don't do when you're doing the fantasy stuff. So unpaid bills and dealing with the Prime Minister of St. Lucia and all those sorts of things. It was an incredible position and I'd love to do it again. And as I said, I think I'm probably more suited to do that than almost anything else other than write about cricket. But it is such a complicated situation. There are so many ins and outs and so many relationships and everything. It is certainly not, I think, what it's not what fans think it is at all. You know, just down to, you know, this player is the most obvious player and I want to get him to my team, but he doesn't like St. Lucia and his wife likes Barbados more. And
fair to say, yeah, it's a multifaceted,
yeah,
role.
It's stuff like that over and over and over again. Me on the phone to an overseas player saying, "I'm willing to pay you not to play so that we have rights on you next year." And him going, "Oh, so you would pay me and I won't play?" "Yes." "Oh, but that means other teams can't bid for me." "Yeah, but we'll pay you near maximum." "But you may not pay me maximum." "No, I may not pay you maximum, but you're getting bonus money for this year that you didn't think you're about to get." So it's a lot of stuff like that. And the team owner's son has a better hotel room than the star player. And the star player is being offloaded on the plane, but the masseuse is on that flight in business class. And it just goes on and on. And, you know, we were such a dysfunctional team. We bad ownership. No proper management, because a general manager really shouldn't be dealing with a lot of these things. And also it had got out of control. But I really enjoyed the bit after the tournament finished of planning how we would get better. You know, having chats with the captain and the coach, chatting to, you know, talent scouts, trying to put together a system of how we can find the best young talent. Also talking to people in St. Lucia and going, you can't sit around and just say St. Lucia is shit. You need to get involved with this. How do I get every young kid in St. Lucia to a talent camp so that I can find one kid that I can have as a professional fielder if I have to? You know, how do I get a reality TV show up about the team? all these sorts of things are, you know, that you need to sort of deal with. I love doing dealing all that. I got sick and tired of talking to agents who were like, no, he's not as fat as he used to be. No, he can definitely bowl now. And me going,
was that Malinga?
Well, Malinga ended up there hilariously, didn't he? You could tell I wasn't involved in that bit, but yeah, it's just like, no, he definitely bowls now. Well, Crickinfo is saying he's bowled 2 overs in the last 18 months. Yeah, but he's bowling in the net. Show me footage of him bowling yesterday with a newspaper in front of him at full pace. You know, those sorts of conversations. I suppose it was actually a lot of fun. But then obviously having the falling out with the owner before the draft, I never actually got to my big draft moment. Every time I've been involved with the draft, it's been as a consultant or with a team that never existed, like Edinburgh Rocks. So I would love to one day plan for a draft professionally and go through the full thing, because you know, it's something I really, really want to do. But yeah, it's a crazy
A brilliant new tournament in the UK that you might be able to get involved with in the near future.
Didn't even get a job interview. Didn't even get a job in the 100. It was quite interesting the way that they went about it. A lot of the coaches brought in analysts and people. And I will probably just snipe from the outside until someone gives me a job. That's it. Literally, the first job offer I got in cricket was from the Melbourne Stars. And I think it was just to shut me up in the media. They were just sick and tired of me pointing out all the things that they were doing wrong. They said, just come and work for us.
Whatever works.
And we got to the final that year. And then they changed the ownership structure and I lost my job anyway. But there you go. It's a very thing. But yeah, I'd love to be a general manager again. But I don't think it's like the American. You're not like trying to think of it's not like Kevin Costner in Draft Day. That's a really random reference because it's probably not. It's not like Brad Pitt in Moneyball. A lot of the stuff that you do is so on a level beneath that. It's an away game and we don't have enough tickets and Candace Warner can't get her kids into the ground. You know, you have to be able to know the people to make those conversations happen and all those sorts of things. And of course, the family of the player should be able to go. But now, you know, the player wants to bring his mistress and his girlfriend and his girlfriend's mistress. And I don't know, you know, you get to those sorts of levels of things. So it's not... It's somewhere sub Billy Beane. If I was ever to write a book about everything that happened, I mean, you wouldn't believe the stuff that went on that is so ridiculous. So I think that, you know, it's a dream position for all sports fans, of which most sports fans would be like, this is shit if they actually had to do it.
Jared, that's, I think, a really good answer to wrap up on. I mean, we could go into a million different, we can go and have a million other conversations from here about T20 franchise leagues around the world, about the role of the general manager in the future. Maybe for another time. We have been speaking to you for over an hour, so we will let you go now. Is there anything you'd like to plug or mention to our listeners before we wrap things up, though?
Oh, I mean, just, you know, I don't want to take subscribers away from you guys, but people should definitely unsubscribe to your podcasts and go over to mine. Double Century is my one on the history of cricket, and Red Inca is my one I do every week. And then I've got a YouTube channel, which is just under my name, where we've been doing some interesting stuff over there. So I'm sure if they like your podcast, they will enjoy those podcasts and those videos as well.
We're not actually too big on YouTube, so I feel happy endorsing your YouTube channel. There's some really good stuff over there. The Neil Wagner video in particular is one I would recommend. Thank you for joining us, Jared. Hopefully we'll speak to you again soon.
No worries. Cheers, guys. Have a good one.
Cheers, Jared. Thank you.
The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
Very good.